Welcome to Podcast 1 of The Way of Perfection, St. Teresa of Avila's Hallmark Spiritual Teaching. This podcast is sponsored by CarmelStream.com, the face of the Carmelite Institute. Now here's your guide, Carmelite Sister Fran Horner.
So now we're ready to begin our first class on The Way of Perfection by Teresa of Avila. I'd like to begin this class by addressing who Teresa was. There is some important background information that I think will inform our reading of The Way of Perfection. Now, many of you may know this information, but it's good to bring it back to our minds and our hearts as we begin this study. As you know, Teresa of Avila was a 16th century mystic and a Carmelite. She was born and lived her entire life, sort of, in Avila, Spain. That's in west central Spain. I say sort of because she made many, many travels and journeys outside of Avila during her life. She was born March 28, 1515, and died on October 4, 1582, at the age of 67. Now, her family background was not, as the Spanish would have said at the time, was not pure. Her father's family were Jewish merchants from Toledo, Spain. We know there's nothing pure or impure about that. It's simply just an ethnic background for our generation. But in her generation, to have Jewish ancestry was a terrible thing. And that's to the shame of humanity that this has gone on for so long. In any event, her grandfather was actually forced to convert to Christianity and was even judged by the Inquisition and had to perform a kind of public penance. He then moved the family to Avila to avoid the taint of this public censure. Now, this story was undoubtedly passed down to Teresa because her concern over the uses of honor and power stayed with her entire life, and we see themes along those lines in all of her major works. She pulls out a consistent teaching that all must be equal, and none held in more honor than another. And we're going to hear this theme over and over again as we go through our class. So, as a young girl in Avila, Teresa dreamed of adventure. There's a famous story of her wanting to run away to the land of the Moors, and that was for the glory of martyrdom. She wanted to do something great with her life. I want to emphasize that because it's important to know that Teresa did have big dreams, and she did have big goals. Of course, as a woman in 16th century Spain, there were going to be some limits to those goals. In 1535, when she was 20 years old, Teresa became a nun, a Carmelite nun, at the huge monastery of the Incarnation in Avila. She did this not out of a particular dedication to God, but actually, she says it of herself, she did it to avoid marriage and to save her soul. Now, marriage at that time was a kind of imprisonment for women. Wives had no freedom and were completely under the domination of their husbands. There's a famous quote by Francisco de Osuna, who was one of Teresa's favorite spiritual writers. He says this: "Since you see your wife going about visiting many churches, practicing many devotions, and pretending to be a saint, lock the door. And if that isn't sufficient, break her legs if she is young, for she can go to heaven lame from her own house without going around in search of these suspect forms of holiness." This quote shows not just the domination, but also the climate for the practice of individual prayer that was present in 16th century Spain, and particularly suspicious when undertaken by women. So Teresa elected the only other option available to her than marriage, which was to become a nun. Now, it's important not to glorify that decision, of hers and say she did it out of deep love of God. She came to a deep love of God, but she didn't begin that way. And I think that can be an encouragement for all of us as we strive to turn our lives ever more in the direction of God. Now, life at the Incarnation, where Teresa first entered, was very serious. It was a good convent, but in many respects, life there was dictated by honor. And we've already heard that would be a stumbling block for Teresa. She would see the wrongness of that approach. There were many people always milling about, visiting. It was noisy. The wealthier sisters were treated far better than the poorer ones. The wealthier sisters got to bring their servants with them. They had bigger rooms, even apartments and suites, as we would say today. For Teresa, this environment did not foster prayer. She was a people person. She loved talking with friends, and she entered into this life, but found ultimately it was too superficial and did not lead her to God. At the age of 39, she had a profound conversion experience in prayer that led her to dedicate herself much more sincerely to the practice of prayer. And it was at that point that she began to dream of retrieving the original Carmelite spirit of prayer by forming a new community. So she did, in fact, go ahead to form a new community. Now, did you realize that she was 47 years old when she did that? I emphasize that so that we can hold in our hearts also that it's never too late to do something great with our lives, that we don't need to only do it when we're 20 and 30. And nothing seemed to stop Teresa. In fact, the last third of her life were far more active and fruitful, at least evidently fruitful, than the first two-thirds of her life. So at the age of 47, she founded a new monastery called St. Joseph's in Avila, which was dedicated to prayer. Later, this became the first foundation of the Discalced branch of the Carmelite family, though it's important to say that Teresa never intended to start a new order. She just wanted to have her reform take hold in the existing order. That wasn't to be, but that had been her dream. This new Carmel was to be limited in number. At first, only 13 sisters, and there were hundreds at the Incarnation. And that was later increased to 21. And they were to be a community of friends. That's how Teresa described her houses. Solitude and enclosure were key to Teresa's new foundation. So you remember the Incarnation had noise, people milling about, servants, anyone could come in and out. That was not the way it was to be at St. Joseph's. Solitude and enclosure meaning the sisters had their private place where others really couldn't pass. These gave not only the proper environment of prayer, the environment of silence, but they also, and we sometimes forget this, they gave a kind of autonomy and independence to the sisters, free from the domination of the prevailing hierarchy, the prevailing male hierarchy, which was so suspicious of women, of personal prayer, and of any pretensions to mysticism. There at St. Joseph's, they were free to pray as they wanted. They were free to have personal prayer. They were free to explore contemplation and mysticism. It's ironic, and really we should consider that Teresa here accomplished exactly the opposite of what Francisco de Osuna had counseled. She actually gave women the freedom to practice their prayer without interference. It was quite radical in an era so suspicious of mysticism. And it's ironic also to note that it was Osuna's book, The Third Spiritual Alphabet, that inspired Teresa's conversion to authentic prayer. So while she was going against Osuna in that respect, she did honor his teachings. That book was probably written for men, but Teresa read it anyway. You might wish to reflect upon why mysticism and contemplation are often held in suspicion by the church. And feel free to comment on this in the class discussion forum. I'll post a question there. I'd be interested in people's exchange of views about that question. This brings us up to her writings, The Way of Perfection, and her other writings. Teresa has five major works which were written in this order. Her autobiography, usually known as The Life, in 1562. That was followed by The Way of Perfection in 1566. And the third major work was The Meditation on the Song of Songs, also in 1566, as best we can date it. This is a less well-known work, but still considered major by scholars, and is really worth studying sometime. Perhaps we'll have a course on that eventually. She wrote her book of the Foundations, telling about all the places that she founded, her journeys across Spain, in 1573. And last, her most mature work, The Interior Castle, in 1577. The Way of Perfection was written to teach the nuns of Teresa's Foundations about prayer. I already suggested something about that to you in the introduction to this class. She had already written so much about prayer in her autobiography, in The Life, but her spiritual directors, which were also her censors, would not allow her to show her life, her autobiography, to her nuns, to her daughters. She was not happy about this and sought and obtained permission, with some delight, to write something specifically for the nuns, and she used the opportunity well, as Teresa always did. The practice of mental prayer was such a significant issue in her day and in her monasteries. Now, we'll talk later, much later really, about the differences between mental and vocal prayer, but just for the time being, consider mental prayer as something that goes beyond the mere recitation of words, some kind of connection with God in relationship. And this was of concern because it could lead to private inspiration, private dedication, and a kind of a contemplation. So officially, it was frowned upon, and yet mental prayer is exactly what was practiced by many of the nuns in Teresa's monasteries, and they wanted instruction in it. Other nuns wanted instruction in vocal prayer, which was far more acceptable. Teresa ingeniously deals with both things in The Way of Perfection, and at the same time defines what it means to be a Carmelite. She does this in two main sections. This semester, we'll look at the first section, chapters 1 through 18, where Teresa elaborates upon the virtues that are foundational for prayer. She sidesteps the issue, then, of what kind of prayer to undertake. She first instructs the nuns how to live. Can you see the genius of that? That she doesn't address the issue head-on, but says, we need to live in a particular way. For Teresa, you see, following the virtues that she's about to lay out is exactly what it is required to be a contemplative. And so that means, by the way, that contemplation is open to all. Live these virtues and you'll become a contemplative, Teresa says. Don't worry about the ins and outs of what mental prayer is. Don't worry about how to practice it. Live these virtues. In the second section of Way of Perfection, chapters 19 through 42, Teresa takes the Our Father, which would have been considered a vocal prayer in her time, and shows how it can be the source for deep contemplation. And that, again, is rather subversive because she's completely blurring or effacing the distinction between vocal and mental prayer. We'll look at those chapters, at that section, in our next semester. Now, the virtues, Teresa says, are the foundations of prayer. And let's first note that she chose virtues instead of concrete concepts to define what it means to live a life in fidelity to the Carmelite charism. She might, for example, have chosen silence and solitude, community and prayer. These are often the three concrete values that Carmel is meant to bring it forward. Silence, solitude, community, and prayer. And Teresa might have chosen those three things as her way of exploring the Carmelite charism. I find it highly significant for all her practicality, which you'll find over and over again, that when she had the chance to specify how to live the Carmelite life, she forsook concrete, static ways to incarnate the life. She chose instead dynamic, relational concepts. Teresa's virtues are founding principles because they can grow and develop with Carmel for as long as we live, as long as Carmel lives. The call to us today is to follow not only Teresa's guidance, but her methods, to look for the behavioral, human, living expression of what it means to be a Carmelite. We can do this by understanding each of Teresa's three virtues and applying them to our circumstances to see what they imply for our present and for our future. And this is what I hope we will be doing as we proceed in the weeks to follow. It's interesting that the general of the Discalced Order, Father Saverio Canestra, OCD, recently endorsed the virtues of the Way of Perfection as the foundation of Carmelite life. This is one reason I can confidently say, as I did in the introduction to this class, if you are learning these virtues, you are a Carmelite. Father Saverio said this, "I feel that the first chapters of the Way of Perfection are the most original and important pages from the viewpoint of the renewal of the religious life, pages where the fundamental intuitions of the Teresian reform are concentrated. Behind her words, there is a new way of thinking about religious life and Carmel, which constitutes the natural complement of the new vision of prayer and spiritual growth of a person in relation with the humanity of Jesus Christ. I think, therefore, that at this particular historical moment of our order, we may not be able to do better than to make those words of Teresa the program of government. The more we fathom them, the more we become aware that the goals which Teresa proposes contain the solution for the serious internal problems of our life, as well as the possibility of expressing something that has concrete meaning for the modern world." So Father Saverio there is saying that these virtues are critical for the future of Carmel and critical for the future of our world, if we could only learn to live them. What are these virtues? Well, if you've skimmed through the book, you'll already know they are charity, detachment, and humility. And I hope that soon, or certainly by the end of this first semester, you can say those by heart: charity, detachment, and humility. Now, I want to make a connection for you between these virtues and the theological virtues, the evangelical counsels, and the human faculties. Now, that's a lot to take in listening to me, but if you check the notes, you'll see that it's all written down there. These connections are very helpful for us. They will become very helpful for us in understanding all that Teresa is trying to say with respect to what I like to call her little virtues as distinguished from the theological virtues. And by having these connections, we can have a better idea how to interpret the virtues and grasp their implications for our lives. The theological virtues that I'm going to ultimately connect with Teresa's virtues are faith, hope, and love. You know those. The evangelical counsels, you think of those as the vows that religious take: chastity, poverty, and obedience. And the human faculties: will, memory, and intellect. Now, I want to make a special note here when you hear the evangelical councils, the vows that a religious take, those of you who are not religious or living religious lives as a religious may say, well, how is that relevant to me? But I hope to show you that these three evangelical councils are extremely important to any follower of Christ. They apply in different ways. They look differently in the lives of different people depending upon their circumstances. But every one of us, no matter what our state in life, can live chastity, poverty, and obedience. And we're going to see that they're going to be key elements of living out charity, detachment, and humility. So I'm going to post, you'll see there's a slide, a page that lays these things out, and I hope you'll print it out. And as we go through the course, you'll be able to write in the related virtue counsel or faculty underneath of Teresa's virtue. So under charity, you'll write whichever one of the virtues connects with that. You'll see as we go along. Now, I contextualize the little virtues of St. Teresa as more practical advice on the heavy-duty purifications that John of the Cross describes as the knights of faith, hope, and love. If any of you have read John of the Cross, you know that he talks about the experience of both what he calls active and passive nights of purification. These times of purification, the dark night of the soul, hit a person very hard and perform a kind of spiritual reworking. And they operate, John says, on the intellect, the memory, and the will. These are the human capacities we mentioned before. You don't have to get all this right away. We're going to spell it out over the course of the next weeks, so just stay with me here. And these purifications bring the soul to possession of the theological virtues, faith, hope, and love. The passive part is God's work, and our only role is to cooperate and accept. That's the truest dark night of the soul, where we're in a kind of darkness and we're letting and waiting for God to do God's work. But there is an active part, John talks about it, where we need to do what we can to dispose ourselves for transformation, for purification. I have to say, in my opinion, John is really bad about giving practical advice about this active part, what to do, how to go about it. At least it's fair to say that if he does give any practical advice, it's not very accessible, at least not to this reader. And that's where the beloved, down-to-earth Holy Mother Teresa of Avila comes in. She was far more down-to-earth, in her writing at least, than John. And her little virtues, what are they again? Chastity, detachment, and humility, are precisely the answer. How to live to dispose ourselves for contemplative prayer and for the purification that leads to union with God. With this introduction, let's now take a brief look at chapters 1 through 3, which I hope you have already read in preparation for this class. In these chapters, some large issues emerge, and they're like the preliminary chapters before we get into the study of the first virtue, which is charity. So in chapter 1, first we have to deal with Teresa's attitude, apparent attitudes towards women. You'll see it right there, and if you open your book in the ICS version, it's page 37, but in every book it's paragraph 2 of chapter 1. Two problematic things come up in that paragraph. Both her reference to the Lutherans and her comment about women. But let's take the women first. She says about halfway down the paragraph, I realized I was a woman and wretched and incapable of doing any of the useful things I desired to do in the service of the Lord. And you'll see some self-effacing comments about women throughout this book. And I want to suggest to you that this is rhetoric, in that it's meant to have a subversive effect, or at least a strategic effect. Teresa had to write for two audiences, her nuns on the one hand, and her superiors, meaning her spiritual directors and other learned men who would be reviewing her writings. In the book Teresa of Avila and the Rhetoric of Femininity, author Alison Weber says that Teresa managed to speak to these two divergent audiences using a rhetoric of irony. This rhetoric was informal and self-effacing. As it was informal, it was non-threatening to her superiors, and it helped her to avoid the Inquisition because it was so self-effacing. I'm a wretched woman. What could they say about that? But in that same informality, she has inspired affiliation and solidarity with her nuns, who would say, she's one with us, we're one with her. Teresa also managed to write in a way that could be interpreted differently by the two audiences. So when she says that her work deserves only a cursory reading by learned men because so much has already been said about prayer, she is actually implicitly suggesting that it should be read very closely by her nuns, and they would have gotten that. In one way, she's using a secret language with them. And so I just say her self-criticism has to be taken with a grain of salt. And I think if you start to attune yourself, you'll become good at spotting Teresa's use of rhetoric. And then I think you might even begin to enjoy it, as I do. You say, oh, there she goes again, and look what she's accomplishing. She says one thing and accomplishes the other. Like in these chapters, there are so many other good things on prayer, I don't have anything to write, but you had better read this. And here I'm going to write it. You see what I mean? It's contradictory. And anyway, she effectively uses her rhetoric to thwart her critics and at the same time win the hearts of her nuns. I'm going to post the relevant excerpt from the book on rhetoric as supplemental reading for this class. Now, the next point about the Lutherans, and that can be quite offensive to us in our ecumenical time, and most likely some of you listening to this lecture are yourselves non-Catholics. This is something one has to take, again, swallow a little bit and know that Teresa was a person writing in her time. I always caution my students not to make saints of our saints in the sense that they can have errors and they can have flaws. And here's one place where Teresa just didn't get it because of her time. It would have been almost impossible for her to have understood the emergence of new religions. And her comments here are driven out of a love for Christ. She completely identified Christ and the church. For her, there was no separation. And so the Protestant movement, for her, was dividing the body of Christ. And she therefore saw it as an evil that had to be stopped, this miserable sect, she says. But I believe if reading her later works, she began to see that this wasn't really the way to go. She who walked such a close line to the Inquisition herself, I think she came to a better understanding. She always wanted a unified church for Christ, but I think she came to an understanding that sometimes people had to speak and stand. In any event, for her, staying within the church was always important, no matter whether she criticized it or didn't feel completely at one with it. And she worried that she might not make it with the Inquisition around. And that was indicated by her famous dying words, "At last I die, a daughter of the church." But for any of you or any of us who sometimes struggle with the church in its present incarnation, it is important to say that Teresa felt that fidelity was important, was critical, even fidelity that tried to stand for its position. In this chapter, Teresa also defines the mission of a Carmelite. In paragraph 5, that is why he has gathered you here. This must be your vocation. These are the business matters you're engaged in. And what is that mission? Well, it's twofold. One is friendship with Christ. That word friends comes up here in paragraph 3, those you have chosen for your friends. That was quite radical. Friendship with Christ had been publicly dismissed as something, a goal for individuals by the time Teresa was writing here. And then the other goal is she relates to the evangelical councils. When she says, this is what you need to do paragraph 2. Follow the evangelical councils as perfectly as you can and strive that the few persons I live with do the same. That's going to connect with her virtues, and you'll see it's a path open to everyone. Now, moving along to chapter 2. Chapter 2 is really addressing honor and poverty. Now, we've already talked a little bit about how honor was going to be a present theme for Teresa during her whole life as she related it to her Jewish heritage. And I want to say, I think I didn't before, that her Jewish heritage was hidden while Teresa was living. Teresa surely knew about it, but it was hidden. And then after her death, her hagiographers really submerged it, because it would have been a blight on her at that time to have known about it. We're glad we know about it today, and it helps us understand what a wonderful thing she was doing in having the courage to see the inequality at the incarnation and the problems that honor was causing, and try to provide a different way. She specifically talks about how money and resources relate to worries, and says you need a kind of poverty of thought. Kind of poverty of thought. I like that expression. And then says this in paragraph 5, I hold that poverty of spirit embraces many of the virtues. In it lies great dominion. I say that it gives again to one who doesn't care about the world's good things dominion over them all. So that's a great idea. She's actually using one of the reversals so common in the Gospels, that the one who doesn't care about the world's good things gains dominion over them all. And so she's saying, choose poverty, don't worry about honor, don't please anyone but God. And these are themes we're going to see repeated later. And finally, in chapter 3, we come on to the apostolic nature of prayer. Teresa was the first one to see prayer as an apostolic activity, that usually only actual hands-on service activities and preaching and teaching are considered apostolic activities. But Teresa says all the people who are out there doing those things need the support of prayer, and it too is apostolic. She talks about how Carmelites are to hold petitions continually in their heart. Let me see if I can find that. Paragraph 6 of chapter 3. In fact, that's one way Carmelites pray their petitionary prayer. It's a matter of mentioning the name and holding it in one's heart. And I'm sure many of you do that too. But holding them there continually. The last thing to say about chapter 3 is the very interesting statement about women in paragraph 7. Here you see, it shows you that the comments we heard about women in chapter 1 were simply rhetoric, because at this particular moment, Teresa basically goes off and says what she really feels. Now, it's not the completeness of what she really feels, because in the first redaction of this text, much, much more was said about the treatment of women, and it had to be taken out in the second redaction, or the book would never have been published. But you see those these phrases in paragraph 7. And you found as much love and more faith in them, the women, than you did in men. Among them was your most blessed mother, and through her merits and because we wear her habit, we merit what? Because of our offenses we do not deserve. Is it not enough, Lord, that the world has intimidated us so that we may not do anything worthwhile for you in public, or dare speak some truths that we lament over in secret, without your also failing to hear so just a petition? Later, there is no virtue in women that they do not hold suspect, she says. So you'll see that she's taking her stand there in defense of women, going on to call her sisters to be virtuous and strong souls. So may all of us be. Well, I'll be interested in any comments you might have about these chapters on the discussion forum. But your first official assignment in terms of writing will be for the next class. I'd like you to read chapters 4 through 7. That's the beginning. Those are the chapters on love or charity. And pick out some phrases that are significant to you and submit them. You'll see this assignment on the site. And I'd like you to make that submission by June 4th. That's 2 weeks from today. So that I'll have a week to review them before we have our next class, where we'll go into this virtue of charity. I look forward to the time when this class will be a bit more interactive, when we can actually have some real-time communication. But in the meantime, please do provide your comments and do your reading, and I look forward to hearing from you soon. God bless.
Are you interested in hearing more about Carmelite spirituality? Visit carmelstream.com, carmelstream.com. Carmelstream, the face of the Carmelite Institute.